Robert Stark. I am joined here with Keith Preston. We'll be covering some of the issues relating to the election and a number of other topics. Keith, great having you back on.
Hey, Robert, thanks for having me back.
So to start off with is, you've had a number of different posts relating to the election. First of all, can you give some of your personal views toward the election? Are you actively involved, or are you more, I know you tend to kind of avoid electoral politics and you have more of an interest in metapolitics.
Yes, I'm not personally involved in the election. In fact, I'm a non-voter. I haven't even voted in an election in well over 20 years now. I tend to have a very critical perspective of the electoral system generally. I do follow it just out of curiosity as a political scientist and historian and sociologist and all the other things that I do. But I do think that this election that's coming up is interesting, mostly because of the outsider candidates that have emerged. What is interesting is that on both sides and within both of the major parties, we have people emerging as major contenders who really aren't even an actual member of the party that they're running for. On the Democratic side, it's only been recently that Bernie Sanders has even become a Democrat. He was an independent for most of the time that he was in Congress and in the Senate, and he only joined the Democratic Party just to run for the Democratic nomination. And now he's giving Hillary a run for her money. And the same is true on the Republican side. It's only been recently that Donald Trump has actually become a Republican. He's actually contributed to and endorsed Democrats quite a bit in the past. And likewise, Trump is now apparently the leading candidate on the Republican side. So I think what this shows is that independent candidates are essentially able to enter into these major parties now and emerge as major competitive candidates. And that's really a rather astounding development. It's also interesting that Bernie Sanders is running for office as an open socialist, as a self-proclaimed socialist. And it's been very rare in American history that a self-proclaimed socialist has been able to achieve the level of following as a presidential candidate that he has. It's really the first time in probably a century, if ever, that an open socialist has had this kind of following as a presidential candidate. And Donald Trump also is bringing a kind of populist, nationalist perspective that has not really been very prevalent, although in some ways I think Trump can be compared to Ross Perot. He has a fairly similar perspective about certain things.
About Donald Trump and the Republican Party. So the Republican Party has traditionally been an alliance between three groups, basically business interests, who basically want lower taxes on the wealthy and less regulation on business, and that would be like groups like the Club for Growth. You have the evangelicals, the religious right, and then you have the foreign policy hawks and the neoconservatives. Even Ronald Reagan made a comment like that. Those are the three pillars of the Republican Party. But Donald Trump is totally different. As you said, he's a lot like Ross Perot. I think ideologically he's much closer to Ross Perot than he is to a lot of these Republican Party icons like Ronald Reagan.
Without a doubt, yeah. In fact, he takes very similar positions on many issues as Ross Perot did. Ross Perot was a staunch economic nationalist, as is Donald Trump, which is a point of view that for quite some time has not been represented in mainstream American politics. Donald Trump is probably less of a fiscal conservative than Ross Perot was. Ross Perot always made the national debt into one of his primary issues, and Donald Trump doesn't really talk about that much. But other than that, though, the two of them do have the same kind of radical center.
I've heard Donald Trump talk about the debt, but his response to the debt is instead he's not coming out for massive cuts. He's talking about like preserving entitlements without increasing spending, but he says that he can grow the size of the economy by bringing back all those jobs from overseas, and that will take care of the budget deficit. But I remember a while back when he was speculating for running for the Reform Party in 2000, and he wrote a book where he actually advocated a massive tax increase on the top wealthiest individuals to pay off the deficit. But now, he's not taking that position. Actually, he's for lower taxes on the wealthy, but I think that has more to do with he doesn't want to alienate the conservative base too much.
Yeah, I think you're probably right in the sense that to really preserve the entitlements, and Trump is actually fairly quote-unquote liberal about some of those kinds of issues. He's all for preserving Medicare, Social Security, and things like that. He's for universal health care, and I think that it would certainly be impossible to do all of that without either raising taxes or without engaging in further deficit spending. Now, Trump may think that the economic nationalist policies that he favors would have the impact of strengthening the economy and encouraging economic growth, which by extension would have the impact of causing tax revenue to increase just through as a result of growth. However, he probably is not advocating tax increases in part because of his base, although his Republican Party base. Although the interesting thing about that is that he doesn't really seem to shy away from taking positions that are offensive. It seems to me that he never really holds much back, even things that would likely offend his constituencies or his supposed Republican constituencies. Like he said a
number
of things.
Like what he did with George Bush. And he even went as far as he said that George Bush he did a terrible job protecting us from 9/11. And then Rush Limbaugh, Rush Limbaugh has actually been fairly sympathetic to Trump for the most part. He went as far as to say Trump is starting to get into Michael Moore territory.
Yeah, and that's interesting because a Republican presidential candidate that attacks the legacy of George W. Bush is certainly going to alienate the hardcore Republicans that are still loyal to George W. Bush. So he's apparently fine with alienating that particular constituency. Now, he may look at it like there's more to gain as far as the big picture by doing that, because outside of that crowd of Bush loyalists, you have a lot of other people, of course, who have a very negative view of George W. Bush, including a lot of Republicans who say, well, you know, that was a mistake to ever elect that guy president. It may be that Trump is banking on that he thinks, well, you know, as a means of expanding his own base at present, he needs to distance himself from the legacy of some of these people. I think that certainly certainly is a plausible strategy. I think that the Bush family is an albatross around the neck of the Republican Party at this point. I mean, look at how dismal Jeb Bush's performance was in this contest. You know, he had the name and all of that, but he got nowhere, and he eventually dropped out.
And I think if Trump is a nominee, which probably will be, I could see a massive political realignment that we haven't seen since Nixon's Southern strategy, and to a lesser degree Reagan and the Reagan Democrats. But I could see massive numbers of like working class white Democrats joining, switching sides. There was a book called What's the Matter with Kansas, and it's the theory of the book, it's from written by a Democrat, and it's about how working class whites vote against their economic interest based on cultural issues. But Trump actually is appealing to these people on economic issues as well. So I could see a massive increase in support in traditionally Democratic states like, say, Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm familiar with that book, What's the Matter with Kansas? It's by Thomas Frank, a leftist writer who argues that working class people, particularly whites, would vote against their own economic interests in the name of social issues like abortion, gay rights, and things like that. I actually don't agree with Frank's thesis. In fact, I wrote an article a few years ago where I debunked Frank's thesis fairly carefully. What I did was I went back and I looked over the results of American elections I wrote this article back in 2009, but I had actually gone back and reviewed the election results for the past couple of decades prior to that in different precincts and districts, and what I found was that it wasn't the case that large numbers of working class people are voting against their own economic interest or voting Republican solely on the basis of social issues. That you do find some of that, but it's contained in certain geographical regions. For the most part, the working class in the United States of all races and ethnic groups is solidly Democratic in terms of its voting patterns. When I say working class, we're talking about people that make, say, $20,000 to $50,000 a year. That's really the working class in terms of income level. So I don't really agree with Frank's thesis. The working class has always been majority Democratic voters. However, I do think that one thing that's interesting about Trump is that he has the ability to get crossover voters of the kind that you're talking about. I think he does have the ability to reach out and get working class, union type voters, white working class people who vote Democratic for economic reasons, but who, for example, may be skeptical of immigration and things like that. And it really hasn't been a Republican for quite some time who's been able to do that. There were Reagan Democrats back in the 80s. Richard Nixon was able to put together a coalition, as you said, using the Southern strategy. But that issue had more to do with race than class.
Geographic regions, working class whites in the South do vote Republican, but in the Midwest, it's maybe a split where maybe they lean slightly Democrat. In the northeastern United States, they definitely are more Democrat. So the Republicans basically have a solid lock in the South for the most part, but Trump would vastly increase their performance in a lot of the Rust Belt states.
Yeah, and I think that's quite possible. I think that in the Rust Belt areas, and that's what I meant earlier, I actually have an article. It's called "Is Something Really Wrong with Kansas?" And if you Google my name or you Google attacksthesystem.com and Google that article, "Is Something Really Wrong with Kansas?" I go over the statistical data. But yeah, you're right in the sense that the working class whites all across the spectrum of the North, the Great Lakes area, the Rust Belt, the Northeast, and also the West Coast consistently vote Democratic. In the South is really the only, and parts of the Midwest, Kansas and places like that, those are really the only places where you find working class or poor whites voting Republican with any kind of regularity at all. And even then, it's spotty. It tends to vary according to precinct and locality. I do see Trump putting together a new kind of political coalition potentially based on economic nationalism and some of the other things that are appealing about Trump. At the same time, though, I'm not so sure how well Trump is going to have an appeal outside of the base that he's created for himself, which basically consists of dissenting sectors among the rank and file Republicans and perhaps crossover voters from from independents and Democrats, primarily white working class. I'm not sure what kind of appeal he would have outside of that or whether he could generate a large enough electoral base to actually win the presidency in a general election. I'm not as convinced of that. I'm not sure. I've seen conflicting reports on that, so I'd be hesitant to make a prediction about that at this point.
So when Trump first got in, I did have a strong degree of a skepticism towards him. Obviously, in politics, you have to be skeptical towards all politicians, but I think Trump basically... He genuinely wants to do this. He genuinely feels strong about these issues. And I also think that the plutocracy views both Trump and Sanders as major threats. So if you look at Trump, he's not perfect, but I do see him as a major threat to the establishment.
Well, it's interesting that Trump is a member of the plutocratic class, but he's somewhat gone rogue. You know, he's certainly stepped outside the boundaries of what are acceptable positions for a member of his class. And I think you're right as well that the establishment does regard both Trump and Bernie Sanders as a significant threat, and because they see these guys as guys that aren't going to play ball as usual. Now, what the establishment wants, the major corporations, the banks, and all of that, they want someone who's just going to be a figurehead who's just going to essentially pursue their own interest and not try to rock the boat any. And that's what elected officials normally do. I mean, that's certainly what Mrs. Clinton would do if she was elected. That's what any of the Republicans other than Trump would do. And it's what Obama has done. It's what George W. Bush did to some degree. Although we could argue that his Iraq war and some of that was a little over the top, even by establishment standards. But I do think that these guys, Trump and Sanders, really are outside the box. I mean, like I said earlier, they're not people that really even represent the parties that they're running under. You know, they've only entered their parties recently just for practical purposes. They're essentially independent candidates for all practical purposes. And it's really almost like there are four parties competing in this election. There's Republicans, the Democrats, and Trump really represents a type of populist nationalism, and Sanders represents the Democratic Socialist left in ways that really amount to an insurgency by minor parties, although given that the major party system is so deeply entrenched, they've done it through entryism into the major parties rather than creating an entirely separate party. And it may actually set a precedent for more of this kind of thing in the future. I mean, in the future, we may see more independents entering the Democratic and Republican Party in the way that these guys have, and that could really alter the fabric of American politics.
Even though our system is rigged against third parties, but do you see some parallels to European politics where you have an establishment conservatives, establishment liberals, but then you also have a strong sort of a socialist movement, and you have these like a nationalist populist movements. Do you see parallels between European politics, which is towards where we're headed?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Trump represents the kind of forces that would in England say vote for UKIP or for the Front National in France or for the Sweden Democrats or something like that, or the Swiss People's Party or the Danish People's Party. The more populist, nationalist, immigration restrictionist framework. And then in Europe, you have the left-wing parties. You have the Greens, the Socialists. In Greece, you've got Syriza and groups like that. And I think Sanders really represents more of that milieu. And, you know, essentially that's what these two guys represent. They represent the more serious left and the more serious right, as opposed to this kind of center-left, center-right, neoliberal, neoconservative paradigm that's dominated for quite some time. You know, up until very recently, many people were thinking this election would just be another Bush-Clinton election. And now Bush is out of it, and Hillary is really struggling. Sanders is giving her a really solid run for her money. And I think that shows that the left, the more serious left and the more serious right, are becoming more viable now.
And there's also a lot of issues where Trump and Sanders overlap. Obviously, one of them, the big issues, is their views on trade.
Yeah, well, the kind of trade policies that the neoliberals and neoconservatives have put into practice in recent decades have decimated the American working class. I mean, it's essentially just gutted the working class, really the middle class. And for that reason, we now have, for that reason and others, we now have the widest class divisions that we have had in the United States at any point in the last 100 years. If we go back and look at what class divisions were like before the Great Depression, we see that class divisions are now very similar in the United States, as well as the partisan divisions and so forth. And there are a lot of things that have contributed to that. I mean, technology has contributed to it and a number of other things. But I really think that these trade deals have been the primary driving force behind this widening class divisions, because the impact it's had is essentially the manufacturing base of the American economy has been pushed out of the United States. I mean, that was the base of the American working to middle class for decades. For generations, the working class was able to maintain a middle class standard of living largely because of high wage jobs in manufacturing, in domestic manufacturing. All that's been decimated through these trade deals and also through outsourcing definitely through outsourcing, but also through automation and things like that. And that has really had a ruinous effect on the working class and the middle class. And I think that that's probably more than anything else the main reason that these two guys, Trump and Sanders, are starting to gain more of an audience. I think you have people on both sides, you know, left and right, Democrat and Republican, liberal and conservative, who see this as really the main issue now. You know, the huge disparities of wealth that we see in American society. I've noticed, for example, that in just looking at the base for both candidates, both of these guys, Trump and Sanders, what I'm seeing is a split within the major parties along class lines. You know, like as over the years, as I've noticed, American class divisions widening. I've always wondered if that would have the impact of a political realignment, where instead of having this red-blue culture war thing being the primary division, instead it would be more class-based politics would become the primary division. On one hand, I think what's happening is that the red-blue divide is as intense as ever. I haven't seen that declining. But within both sides, within the red tribe and within the blue tribe, we see class divisions emerging. We see Trump on the Republican side is appealing more to working class, working to middle class people that are socially or politically conservative, and whereas the more elite neocons are in favor of people like Rubio and all of that. And we see the same thing on the other side. I've noticed that Bernie Sanders supporters tend to be college students, working class liberals, and old hippies and people like that, whereas Hillary supporters tend to be more professional types that are mostly interested in, you know, race, gender, and gay identity politics and things of that nature.
That's basically what I was going to get at. If you analyze the demographics of Trump supporters and Sanders supporters, the key difference between them is cultural. Trump supporters include people who might be like, he's popular with people who'd be seen as kind of like rednecks, and maybe, not in all cases, but a significant number. And a lot of Sanders supporters are people who are more kind of culturally in the left. So the key divide between them is cultural. But I think if you analyze them, the key thing they have in common is they're both predominantly white, and they're both predominantly in reaction to the destruction of the white middle class. And I think that's the common ground that they have.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. If you look at Hillary supporters, they're a sort of coalition of wealthier whites and a minority interest.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that what we see is a class division emerging on both sides. We see a class division emerging on the left and on the right, where you have the elite, more professional class, more affluent and wealthy liberals and conservatives being pitted against working class people on both sides. I think that's definitely the case. And I think that probably indicates that this will continue to influence and shape American politics in the future. Depending on how well Trump and Sanders do when it's all over, this may be a situation that leads to even more radical candidates emerging. You know, we may see more independent or formerly independent candidates emerging with even more radical views at some point in the future.
What do you think about some of the social justice warrior attacks on Sanders? I know one of them, originally Black Lives Matter movement attacked him, which is absurd because Bernie Sanders marched in the civil rights movement. And he's talked about a lot of the issues they care about, like ending police brutality, ending mass incarceration. But they ended up, the Black Lives Matter interrupted his speech, and he kind of caved into them. And then also you had Gloria Steinem attacking him, and you had Madeleine Albright saying that women who vote for Hillary over Bernie have a special place in hell.
Yeah, and that represents a split that's taking place on the political left, and it's one that I've always thought would happen eventually, in that you have all of the you have several splits taking place. You have all of the different identity groups turning on each other. I'm starting to see that on a more frequent basis. But you also see a big split emerging between the bread and butter left and the identity politics left. Sanders supporters tend to be people who are on the left mostly for economic and class reasons. You know, they may be liberal or left in their cultural values as well. They may have no problem with gay marriage. They may have no problem with, say, immigration or anything. But they also vote with their pocketbooks, and they see the left as representing their own economic interests. I think that for the people that you just mentioned that are attacking Sanders, I think they vote with their identity interests. You know, they see the system as a means of achieving upward mobility, either for themselves personally or for their reference groups. And they're not as motivated by bread and butter issues. They're more oriented by identity interests. I mean, Gloria Steinem is an obvious example. Gloria Steinem supports Hillary simply because she wants there to be the first woman president. I mean, that's obvious. That doesn't even need explanation. And same thing with Albright, of course. Well, in addition to the fact that Albright is an old crony of Hillary's. But and the same thing is true with Black Lives Matter. I think that I think they look at it like, well, Sanders is just a white guy talking about economics, and he's actually Jewish. I mean, some people count that as white, some people don't, but I think they probably would view it that way. And I think that what we're starting to see is something I've noticed on the far left for quite some time, and that you have this big split between leftists that are class-oriented towards class-based politics, and those that are oriented towards more identity-based politics. That's all over the place on the far left and has been for years, but it seems to be working its way more into the mainstream. And I think that these social justice warrior people are interesting because I think that they're having the impact of actually turning off a lot of people to their own causes. On one hand, they're doing what I always thought they would do, in the sense that the bigger their movement got, I always thought they would become more extreme and fanatical and ridiculous in terms of their rhetoric and tactics and things like that, and that seems to be happening. But they're also alienating a lot of people, and they're also turning a lot of people against them, and they're turning on each other quite a bit. So I see that as really a separate current. I don't think that's the current that's really driving the Sanders insurgency at all. There may be some social justice warrior types who support Sanders, but I think they're just as likely to be, if they're into mainstream electoral politics, I think they're just as likely to be Hillary supporters.
If Sanders loses to Hillary, and at this point I think Hillary will win, but I do think Sanders will make a big impact, do you think a significant number of Sanders supporters would consider voting for Trump?
I don't know about that. There's probably some, but I think though that the cultural divide between the left and right is real. It's very deep and it's very bitter. And people who would be drawn to Sanders, there are certainly some people who would be drawn to Sanders that might cross over and vote for Trump if economic issues really are all they care about. But I know of a lot of Trump. I mean, I know a lot of Sanders supporters, or know of a lot of Sanders supporters, who are very adamantly anti-Trump. They're just as anti-Trump as the Hillary supporters are. And I think that cultural divide is real. You know, I know for many years I worked on trying to put together a coalition of left and right, again, around common issues like anti-war issues and civil liberties issues and some economic issues. And what I found is that while there would be people, there would be handfuls of people on both sides that would understand the issues. As a general rule, the degree of hostility and division that exists among the left and right on a cultural sense is very real and deeply entrenched. And what I started noticing when the Tea Parties and Occupy Wall Street came along is that both sides, both the left and the right, were starting to get increasingly concerned about class divisions and the economic situation in the United States, but in such a way that they were totally opposed to each other. And what I was talking about earlier is what I think has happened instead, in that what we're starting to see is, as class issues have become more to the forefront, you're starting to see splits on both ends of the spectrum. The left is splitting among itself along class lines, and the right is splitting among itself along class lines. But the left and the right, in some taken in toto, are still just as opposed to each other as they ever were. So I don't, as to whether Trump would have much appeal to Sanders supporters, I'm not so sure about that. I'd be somewhat skeptical of that.
I mean, I've been talking about this concept called radical centrism, which is combining aspects of the best aspects of the left and the best aspects of right against the establishment. I think the original context of that was combining like the best aspects of, say, a Ralph Nader and a Pat Buchanan. And that's mm-hmm. what I personally ideally would like to see in politics, but I think would be very difficult to pull off because of all the barriers to it.
Yeah, you know, I've been working on issues like that for decades now, and that's what I have found as well. There's just a really deep-seated and deeply entrenched hostility between the different camps. I think on the left in particular, there's just no interest in working with anybody outside the left. I think there are people on the left that don't want to work with libertarians on anti-war issues. You know, there are people on the left who have no interest in working with, you know, paleoconservatives or economic nationalists on class issues either. And more I see this kind of polarization taking place on both the left and
the
right.
Nader is basically like the only one I can think of who's open-minded to it.
Yeah, well, as far as any well-known figure, I think that's the case. Yeah, I think that's generally the case. And I think Nader has the advantage of being an older fellow whose politics were shaped before all of the culture war stuff that came later. And I think that, you know, when I talk to people about these issues, I find a lot of people just have a really knee-jerk, you know, reflexive hostility to what they think the other side is. You know, it's really almost like football teams or something like that. You know, the fans of the Dallas Cowboys and Washington Redskins or whatever, just they hate each other because they hate each other. It's not even rational. And I see that happening in American politics. It's almost like the conflicts you see between religious communities and like Protestants and Catholics in Ireland or Sunni and Shia in Iraq. Now, fortunately, it hasn't degenerated into a civil war, but it is that kind of tribalistic mentality. You know, they are them and we are us. And a lot of times when you ask people to explain why they think this way, they can't really come up with anything that they think is rational. It's like they're just appealing to, you know, it's like their views have been shaped by slogans and sound bites and rhetoric that they've gotten from their favorite media outlets or affinity groups or whatever. So the idea of trying to put together any kind of left-right coalition around common issues seems fairly difficult, although it does happen in some cases around individual issues. I have noticed, for example, that when it comes to criminal justice reform, that's an issue I'm interested in, I do see some effort by conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats or left and right people to work on some of these kinds of issues, you know, that they, you know, where both sides see a problem with, say, the criminal justice system. But other than single issues like that are somewhat outliers, I don't really see much cooperation between left and right on anything. If anything, I think the divide is even wider than it once was. Even as class divisions are just as wide, the way that that's manifesting itself, as I said, is you see splits along class lines within the left and within the right, in addition to the conflict between the left and the right.
I've also found that true with the libertarians. I've talked to libertarians, and you can agree with them basically on like a lot of the basic principles, like individual civil liberties. But if you even have like any kind of disagreement with them, they'll automatically write you off as like a statist or a fascist or a communist.
Well, not only that, but I think that libertarianism is sort of a microcosm of the wider conflict, because increasingly what I've noticed among libertarians is that libertarianism itself is split up into multiple factions. And there are some that are more conservative libertarians or right-leaning libertarians who...
So your example of that would be like Sean Gabb from the Libertarian Alliance UK?
Yeah, although Sean is British and not an American, so he's not as shaped by or influenced by the kinds of political divisions you see in America along cultural lines.
Well, there's also Ilana Mercer, Hans from
Ilana is a better example. Yeah, Ilana is basically a libertarian. Ilana is basically a paleo libertarian or a libertarian with paleo conservative leanings. And you find some right-leaning libertarians now who are also interested in the neo-reactionary movement, and some have actually quit being libertarians and become neo-reactionaries or become alt-rightists or whatever. But then you see some libertarians going the other way. You see others like the Center for a Stateless Society who have become full-blown social justice warriors. And you see that kind of split going on. I've seen it within the Libertarian Party. I've seen it within all sorts of libertarian organizations. You know, then you've also have a third brand of libertarianism that's largely been co-opted by the neocon alliance that are just, you know, incorporated into the Republican umbrella, like say the Cato Institute or like Rand Paul and that kind of stuff.
What do you think about that article by Richard Spencer about Rand Paul called "The Death of a Libertarian Populism"?
I read that article when it came out, when Richard posted it. I don't remember a whole lot about it, except I remember thinking I agreed with it at the time. I largely agreed with it. I'm not sure if I would exactly have the same perspective on it as Richard, but the problem with Rand Paul, though, is that he pursued what was probably the worst possible strategy. On one hand, he was out there trying to make sure he didn't offend the standard Republican Party voters. You know, he was kowtowing to the neocons on this or that foreign policy issue. He was kowtowing to the religious right on this or that social issue. But then he was out there trying to present himself as being friendly to blacks and other minorities. And I think that, and at the same time, trying to appear not too radical or not too extreme either. And that was the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, what made Ron Paul as popular as he was being a maverick and being an outlier and being a guy that says, you know, I don't really care what you think of me or not. This is my message. And people respected that. And he took radical positions. Rand was trying to play politician, and it totally backfired. I mean, he did just about everything that I would have advised him not to do if I had been his top advisor.
Yeah, the first thing he did during the debates was he attacked Donald Trump for not being a real Republican.
Yeah, I mean, what is that? You know, I mean, that's what people want to get away from. They want to get away from party politicians. That's why these guys are so popular, Trump and Sanders. He had completely, he essentially blew his father's entire legacy with his campaign. I mean, he was primed to inherit his father's legacy and just completely blew it. The problem, though, that I see with libertarianism in its present form is that it hasn't really been able to position itself as any kind of autonomous force that is in opposition to established ideologies. Instead, libertarianism has become splintered into multiple factions, you know, some of which are just another part of the blue tribe, some of which are just another part of the red tribe. And libertarianism has not really been able to gain any distinctive and independent identity for itself as an actual third force or third position or anything like that. You know, you have some right-leaning libertarians that are just red tribers, and you have others that are just blue tribers, others that have been co-opted by the neocons, and there's nothing, and the ironic thing about that is that it still doesn't get libertarians any points in any of the different camps that they've entered. Like, even these left libertarians, these free market anti-capitalist people, even they are widely I don't know if despised is the right word. They're widely distrusted by the more conventionally, social democratic, progressive left, you know, and even by left anarchists. Even a lot of left anarchists consider them to be right wingers, even though they're full social justice warriors in many instances. So I really think that has been a problem that libertarianism has been unable to overcome. And that's why right now in this year, we don't really see any libertarian candidates that are major contenders. Instead, we see a populist nationalist Trump and a democratic socialist Sanders. We don't really see any libertarians that are comparable. And I think that's why libertarians just haven't been able to establish an independent identity for themselves as a distinctive oppositional force. They're just an appendage to all these other camps.
So you have this article called The Two Flavors of Tyranny, Red or Brown, and it's by a libertarian writer, and the premise of the article is they're making a comparison to Weimar Germany, and they're saying that we have basically this corrupt establishment that is losing its illegitimacy, and he's trying to say that Bernie Sanders represents communism and Donald Trump basically represents the movement that led to the rise of Hitler. So it's an interesting article, but I think at the same time, I think it's a stretch to try to say that basically it's still sort of the tactic of saying that Donald Trump is even though you can make a case that there are a lot of similarities to Weimar Republic, definitely. He's using that as an opportunity to say that Donald Trump is basically a fascist. So the article has interesting points, but it's a flawed article at the same time.
Yeah, it's an article by Jeffrey Tucker, who is well known in libertarian circles. But yeah, I agree with you in this. I actually wrote a somewhat similar article myself about 10 years ago. But on one hand, there are some interesting parallels in that in Weimar Republic, what you had was a system where you had a liberal democracy where the center was unable to hold. They could never form a stable government from the center. And what happened was that politicians would continually reach out to the far fringes of the left and right in order to create a base for themselves. And then the economy blew up as well in Weimar, and that really fueled the growth of extremist movements like the communists, the KPD on one end, and the National Socialists on the other end. So some of what we see going on in the United States today is similar in a very limited way. But the idea that Sanders represents the coming of communism to America, or Trump represents the new Hitlerism or something like that is ridiculous. I mean, I don't know how many articles and Facebook comments and blog posts and all kinds of things I've seen in recent months talking about how Donald Trump is the second Hitler or something like that, which is nonsense. I mean, first of all, as we were talking about earlier, Trump's actual politics are pretty much, a type of radical center. I don't even know how radical. It's just it's a type of Ross Perot-like centrist populism.
Even on social issues, like I think personally Trump is more socially moderate, but he realizes he needs to appeal to the evangelicals to win.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. For people who keep saying that Trump is a fascist, they obviously have no understanding of what historical fascism actually was. Anyone who is within the paradigm of a democratic state, no matter how liberal or conservative they are, is not a fascist. There's no evidence, for example, that Donald Trump actually wants to eliminate democratic elections and things like that, the standard liberal democratic practices in the United States, and replace it with a full-on strong-arm dictatorship, right? But a true fascist would. And in fact, you can even be part of the anti-democratic right and not be a fascist. You can be an advocate of a monarchy, of a hereditary aristocracy, of some sort of elitist nationalism, authoritarian nationalism, even a military dictatorship. You can be all of that without being a fascist. Fascism is something that's more extreme than any of that. And of course, Nazism
is even... Well, it's become kind of a euphemism for any kind of movement that a person dislikes.
Right, yeah. Well, any kind of movement from the right that somebody thinks is reactionary or whatever. Yeah. But I mean, the fascism is one of the most abused words in the English language. And the same is true with Bernie Sanders. I keep seeing a lot of conservative-oriented, Republican-oriented, libertarian-oriented memes going around on Facebook and elsewhere talking about how Bernie Sanders is a communist, and you'll see a picture of Sanders with a hammer and sickle in the background, and that's nonsense as well. Sanders' actual politics is just that of a New Deal Democrat. I mean, in the 60s, he would have been well within the mainstream of the Democratic Party. This is before neoliberals completely took over the Democratic Party in the 1990s in the Bill Clinton era. You know, Sanders is just an unreconstructed New Deal Democrat. I mean, I don't even know that he even qualifies as a socialist under any intelligent meaning of that word. I mean, he, in the sense, if you define socialism merely as advocating a large welfare state or a large social safety net, then yeah, I guess you could say he's a socialist, a democratic socialist. But that's not really what socialism is. I mean, socialism is the idea of the collective ownership of the means of production in some particular way. And I've seen no evidence that Sanders wants to nationalize entire industries or, you know, have a workers' revolution that seizes the means of production and sets up workers' councils or something like that. He's just a welfare statist, basically. So the idea that he's a Marxist is a bit of a reach as well. But I think that rhetoric illustrates the polarization that we find in American society when it comes to politics. You know, the two sides are always calling each other communists and fascists and things like that, even though
other Republicans they've gone as far as to call Donald Trump a socialist for his stance on health care. Also, Donald Trump in one speech, he sort of briefly flirted with the idea of taxing Wall Street like Bernie has.
Yeah, well, the Republicans, the establishment Republicans and the neoconservatives have gone completely off the deep end in their attacks on Trump. The National Review put out a special issue where something like a couple of dozen leading, quote-unquote, conservative opinion leaders were attacking Trump. Some of them were comparing him with Hitler. Some of them were comparing him with saying he was too liberal or he was too progressive. I mean, the statements of these people were all completely contradictory with one another. But what it is that Trump really does threaten the Republican establishment, and he really is throwing a wrench in the neocon machine. And the neocons weren't prepared for this, and they're desperately trying to regroup and launch a counterattack, and they have no idea how to go about doing that. It just kind of hit them out of the blue. And I see the same thing, ironically, happening on the Democratic side. What's interesting, though, is I haven't seen the establishment Democrats really attack Sanders with quite the zeal that the neocons have attacked Trump. But I do think that what they're trying to do instead is appeal to identity politics issues, and that's why you have somebody like Madeleine Albright out there saying, you know, women that don't vote for Hillary deserve a special place in hell or something like that. I think that's really the angle that the Clinton campaign would probably take. I suspect that if Hillary, if come the summertime when the parties do their nominations and that kind of thing, if Sanders is continuing to give Hillary a very strong challenge, I think more and more Hillary's rhetoric will lean in that direction. She'll try to say, I'm the candidate of women, I'm the candidate of minorities, I'm the candidate of gay people. This Sanders guy is just an old white male. She'll try to take that kind of angle, whereas I think Sanders is actually a very good campaigner. Sanders has been a very good campaigner in the sense that, you know, he's not a charismatic figure. You know, he's not some really well-spoken person either. You know, he's not Trump in the sense that he has the ability to just appeal to people with shock and outrage, kind of a Howard Stern approach. And he's not Barack Obama. He's not an eloquent speaker either. But what he is able to do is just hammer home on a core issue that is
kind of
important
like
to a lot of. Yeah, he's able to just hammer home on this issue of growing inequality of wealth in terms of rich and poor and class issues. That's really his only issue. You know, class divisions and income disparity is really Sanders' only issue, and that's what he keeps hammering. He just keeps hammering that same point over and over and over again, and there's a niche for that. You know, there are people out there who know that that's an issue, it affects them personally, and they want to hear about that. And as long as he keeps doing that and just doesn't steer from that script, I think he's got some serious potential to give Hillary a very strong challenge.
Do you think in the general election, if Trump is a nominee, do you think he could go more in a populist direction on economics?
I think he would. I think Trump understands that he needs to present himself as being a kind of people's candidate. I think that if he becomes the Republican nominee, I think what you'll see him do is he will veer away from the right a bit, and I think he will become a little bit more centrist-oriented. I mean, he already is to some degree, but I think what I've seen him do recently is shore up his support among the Republican base, among conservatives. You know, he went to speak at the Falwell University, Liberty, and things like that, and he's been trying to appeal to a lot of that crowd. And I think, though, that he'll moderate that a bit if he becomes the nominee, and he'll start thinking about, okay, how am I going to get the majority of Americans to vote for me? Not how am I going to get the Republican nomination, but how am I going to get the majority of Americans? And I think that, you know, economic populism, which once again is really his main issue anyway, I think for both of these guys, Trump and Sanders, economic populism is really their main issue. And I think that he will increasingly steer his rhetoric in that direction.
So you have this post, and it's a foreign policy report card. And this is from the site American Conservative. And this is coming from a non-interventionist perspective. So it gives each candidate a report card grade based on their foreign policy. So overall, Carson, Rubio get Fs. So those candidates basically they're perceiving them as being the most hawkish, like neocon candidates. Hillary Clinton's given a D. I basically think Hillary Clinton, if elected, would be a lot more hawkish than Obama is.
I think so. Yeah, I agree with that.
Cruz is given a D. Sanders is given the best grade, a B, and they give Trump a C. So they're basically saying, out of all those candidates, they're sort of implying that Trump is a mixed bag on foreign policy.
Yeah, I think he is. Trump, for example, opposes the deal with Iran, the peace agreement with Iran. He has made comments about invading Iraq and taking their oil as reparations for the war. He has defended the use of torture of terrorism suspects, you know, waterboarding and all of that. His track record on foreign policy is very mixed. He's obviously not a neocon. He's not zealous for invading the world on behalf of spreading democracy or whatever.
And the neocons have attacked him for his comments saying that he can get along with Russia and for his other comments about the Iraq war.
Yeah,
and they've also
accused
him of not being sufficiently pro-Israel because he made a comment a few weeks ago that he'd be more neutral on Israel.
Well, not only that, he was speaking to some sort of Jewish organization saying, you're not going to be able to buy me with your money or something like that at one point.
Oh, yeah. Jewish Coalition.
Yeah, he's definitely not a neocon. He's not a neocon. He doesn't have the hostility to Russia that they have. He does not have the zeal for supporting Israel that they have. He's not nearly as a strong an advocate of aggression in the Middle East as they are. So he's definitely not a neocon. And that's the main thing that the neocons dislike about him. That's why they attack him so fervently, is because they know that. They know he's not one of them on foreign policy, which is the only issue they really care about. I think Trump would be more cautious in many ways as a president, in the sense that I don't really see Trump running off half-cocked and invading Iraq the way that George W. Bush did. I think he would be more prudent than that. As far as the war in Libya in 2011, I don't really see Trump as somebody that's going to intervene in a foreign country under the banner of human rights or something like that. I don't see him doing that. I certainly think he would be less antagonistic towards Russia. I think he probably would look at it like, you know, there's really no reason why the United States and Russia cannot coexist peacefully. He probably is sincere when he says that he admires Putin in many ways, because they're similar to each other in certain ways.
I think where the parallel is where they're similar is Putin was someone who, under the Yeltsin administration, he's someone who kind of worked within the system. And then once he got into power, he turned things around. Like, he cracked down on a lot of the oligarchs. So I do see a lot of similarities between Trump and Putin.
Yeah, I think there are certain similarities, and again, I think that's another reason why the neocons attack him the way that they do. I think he's perhaps concerned that he'll crack down on them, as well as rejecting their foreign policy agenda and things of that nature. And I think, though, that Trump would probably, all things considered, be less interventionist than any other candidate. From what I've seen of Trump's comments on foreign policy, some of which I don't agree with. He said a lot of things about foreign policy I don't agree with. But I still think that he's not as bad as Hillary on foreign policy. I don't think he's as bad as any of the other Republicans, at least none that would have any chance of winning on foreign policy, like Cruz or Rubio or any of those guys. The only other candidate that would perhaps be superior to Trump on foreign policy would be Sanders.
Sanders is not perfect either. He voted for the war in Kosovo.
Yeah. He has a voting record that reflects a kind of liberal internationalist view. He's not a left-wing anti-imperialist, and if you can find leftist websites and writing that criticize Sanders for this. For example, the people at Counterpunch.org, that's a hard left, hardcore anti-imperialist left website, and they attack Sanders on those grounds. There's a fellow named Navid Nasser, who is a foreign policy international relations coordinator, and he's attacked Sanders quite a bit on these grounds. And I've even seen criticism of Sanders of a similar type by the Trotskyites at World Socialist website. So he's not on the far left when it comes to foreign policy issues. He comes close to being a standard brand liberal internationalist.
One way I've heard Trump's foreign policy outlook described is as a Jacksonian foreign policy. And basically, a Jacksonian foreign policy outlook is you have a strong military as a deterrent, but you try to avoid foreign conflicts as much as possible. But if you're absolutely forced into conflict, then you do have to be totally ruthless. What do you think about that perspective as Trump as a Jacksonian?
Well, that's not just a Jacksonian perspective. That's more of a realist perspective. Foreign policy realists tend to have that kind of outlook, that foreign policy should be restrained, it should be prudent, you should use war as a means of achieving objectives only when necessary, but when you do, you need to go all out and kick ass and win as soon as you can. That's not an uncommon point of view. That's what you normally find with the realist school of foreign policy. It's a point of view, ironically, that's not that familiar to most Americans, because the two dominant foreign policy paradigms that we see in the United States are liberal internationalism, and that's what the Democrats are. They believe in working through the United Nations and other international organizations, essentially for the sake of policing the world. And the neoconservatives advocate a type of unilateral American imperialism, just full-on militarism. In a way that's rather extreme. But the realist perspective is arguably a more restrained point of view than either of the other two. But they do believe in, going and kicking ass when you do go to war. So they're not pacifist, and they're a little more, I won't say interventionist. They're not as isolationist as the paleoconservatives tend to be. They're a little bit more moderate about that.
So Trump he's not a paleoconservative, but in general I would say that paleocons have a more favorable view of him, while a lot of neocons have a visceral hatred of him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
What do you think are the key issues why the neocons have such a visceral hatred of him? Is it ideological or more because he threatens their power?
Well, he's throwing a wrench in their political machine. That's the first thing. He threatens their hegemony over the Republican Party. And there are ideological differences as well. He has no particular animus towards Russia. The neocons are intimately anti-Russian. He's not particularly zealous for American intervention in the Middle East, and that's really the main agenda that the neocons have. He's rather indifferent to Israel when compared to the neocons. Israel is the primary area of concern for the neocons. Also, he takes a more populist view of a wide range of issues than they do. And the neocons are basically effete, cosmopolitan professionals, intellectuals, academics. You could say that they are moderate liberals on social issues. They are probably moderate liberals or centrists on economic issues. You know, they're not gung-ho leftists on economic issues. They generally believe in what they call democratic capitalism. You know, they believe in the free market economy plus the welfare state that regulates it and the public interest and all of that. But they're not libertarians. They're not hardcore economic conservatives. What makes the neocons into such an extreme group is their views on foreign policy. They are radical imperialists. That's really their overwhelming perspective. You know, they're fairly middle of the road, even quasi-liberal on everything else, but they're radical imperialists on foreign policy. They're about worldwide military intervention in the name of spreading democratic capitalism, particularly when it comes to the defense of Israel. That's really their main area of interest. They have a strong hostility towards the Russians. I think probably the main reason for that is the Russian tradition of anti-Semitism. I think that's really the root of that, as well as just regarding Russia as a reactionary, you know, backward, you know, quasi-feudal society. That's how they tend that's how they tend to see Russia. So I think that the ideological differences between Trump and the neocons are vast, but I also think there are just some practical institutional and political differences as well. Trump is throwing a wrench in their machine.
And also, not just the neocons, but a lot of these business groups like the Club for Growth also despise them as well.
Well, yeah, because all they care about is the economic interest of the upper class. I mean, they want to cut taxes for rich people. They want to deregulate their own businesses. They don't want anything getting in the way of trade, international trade, and, you know, investment in, you know, third world countries where they have access to cheap labor and where there's no environmental protections and things like that. That's what these you know, so-called pro-growth business-oriented groups want. So, you know, and Trump isn't really about that either. Trump is an economic nationalist. He's advocated a high tariff wall in the name of protecting domestic employment. That's the last thing that these kinds of corporate interests want.
Where do you see Trump on civil liberty issues like the NSA spying on American citizens?
I think he's pretty weak on those kinds of issues. He's very anti-Edward Snowden, for example. He even called for Edward Snowden's execution at one point, I think. He's defended the use of torture on terrorism suspects. He has a lengthy history of being very pro-law and order and things of that nature, and that just seems to be an endemic part of his personality. And in fact, it's the aspect of his thinking that I find the least appealing. I think he's actually more restrained on foreign policy than either Hillary Clinton or any of the other Republicans. I think he's better on economic issues than Hillary Clinton or any of the other Republicans. But on civil liberties issues, I don't know that he's worse than Hillary Clinton or any of the other Republicans. But I that's the area of his thinking that I tend to find the most problematic. He's not a libertarian by inclination at all.
So on most issues, basically kind of to summarize things up, I agree with that perspective, because on most issues he would be dramatically better than the other candidates and existing politicians. The civil liberties thing is probably his biggest flaw, but at the same time, if he were president, I don't think he would make civil liberties any worse. If anything, he would probably keep things kind of at the status quo on that issue.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, he's not going to be any worse than Hillary or any of the neocon candidates. So, yeah, I mean, I don't consider it a major issue.
One other issue about Trump is, would you say he has kind of an anti-environmental streak?
I don't really know much about Trump's positions on environmental issues. I know that he rejects global warming as a scientific theory. I think he belongs to the category of climate change deniers, or whatever you would call them, and I don't really see him as having very quote-unquote liberal or progressive views on the environment. He seems to be more on the other side when it comes to that. So no, he's not an environmentalist candidate. Other than that, I'm not really that familiar with his views on the environment.
I think to summarize things up, as far as Trump goes, I pointed out Trump's flaws, but he's still dramatically better than anyone else, especially Hillary Clinton, Marco Rubio, or any. Basically, he would be a vast improvement over any president we've had in like the last 30 or 40 years. Is there anything else you'd like to add about either Trump or Sanders before I wrap things up?
Well, just to reiterate what I said earlier, in that what I think is interesting about them is that they're both essentially independent candidates who are entering the major parties solely for the sake of convenience and are being competitive by doing so, which is very unusual. And hopefully that will be the start of a trend in the future where more such candidates, perhaps even better ones, start to emerge. And also, as I said earlier, I do think that they represent class divisions that are emerging on both the left and the right. Just as the red-blue cultural divide and political divide is very wide, so are class divisions as well. And we're starting to see the class divisions of that type emerge on both sides of the spectrum as well. And I think these candidates really represent that. And it will be interesting to see where that goes in the future.
Keith Preston, it's been a great show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
All right. Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.